Thank you for listening to this forum podcast. Please check out our website for a rich archive of podcasts and writing from contemporary philosophers and other researchers on a wide variety of topics. The Forum is an educational charity dedicated to bringing academic philosophy to a broader audience. Please consider donating to us via our Just Giving page, which you can find on our website. Happy listening.
So I'd just like to begin by thanking Beth for organizing the event, as well as Peter Dennis here in the front row. This wouldn't have been possible without your help. So I'm going to begin by just saying a little bit about, to introduce the talk, a little bit about Heidegger, and then I'll let my esteemed colleagues do the rest of the talking this evening. So Martin Heidegger was one of the most important and influential figures in 20th century philosophy. His magnum opus, Being in Time, and his later essays on language, truth, and art transformed the philosophical tradition he inherited and inspired other significant philosophical movements in the 20th century, such as Jean-Paul Sartre's existentialism, Hans-Georg Gadamer's hermeneutics, and Jacques Derrida's deconstruction. Heidegger's work has also had an impact on disciplines outside of philosophy, including theology, anthropology, history, the visual arts, biology, deep ecology, and environmental studies. Finally, Heidegger has recently been in the papers after the publication of his private and infamous black notebooks from the 1930s and 1940s. These notebooks are an indication of Heidegger's anti-Semitism, and they complicate the picture we have of Heidegger's involvement in National Socialism. Although important, the black notebooks will not be the focus of the discussion today. Instead, we will talk about Heidegger's work on technology. And so with me here today to talk about Heidegger on technology is Babette Babich. Babette is professor of philosophy at Fordham University. Taylor Carman. Taylor is professor of philosophy at Barnard College, Columbia University. Patricia Glazenbuch. Patricia is professor of philosophy at Washington State University. And Daniel Dastrom. Dan is professor of philosophy at Boston University. So let's get things started. Taylor, what is technology and why is it important for Heidegger?
Good question. Well, so the first thing to know about Heidegger on technology is that when he talks about technology, and I think when we talk about technology for the rest of this discussion, it's very important to know that he doesn't mean, and we won't be meaning, the technological instruments and devices that are what usually the word refers to. When Heidegger talks about technology, what he's interested in, what he's talking about, is really the technological understanding of the world and the technological understanding of ourselves and everything. That's what he calls an understanding of being. So it's the technological understanding of being that he's interested in. That's to say, how we understand the whole of entities, the totality of entities, what entities are, what it is for something to be. Heidegger thinks that we have this kind of usually tacit background understanding of the way things are. And since about the end of the 18th century, since roughly industrialization, Heidegger thinks we understand everything as a kind of resource material to be used, manipulated, controlled, ordered, so that it's on command, on demand, to be used and manipulated in a very flexible sort of way, and that this applies to everything there is. Things are at their best when they're flexible, efficient, and available for use, and that includes us. So his word for this way of understanding things is to call them in German Bestand, which means something like resource material or standing reserve, stuff that's just there at the ready to be used at any moment. So it's not the specific gadgets and devices that are technological that, as we usually, when we say technology, we usually mean all that stuff. He's really interested in that as our use of things as symptomatic of a deep way of seeing the world, of understanding the world, and for a way for the world to make sense to us. And Heidegger thinks that every understanding of being, it affords us access to things, But each one also hides something and distorts something and has kind of implicit dangers in it. So he's worried about the technological understanding of being. And that's a lot of what we're going to be talking about later, I think, is what he thinks the dangers are that's built into it. But what I want to emphasize is that the technological understanding is at a deep background level of our relation to the world. It's not a set of beliefs. It's not something that's usually explicit that you can just articulate and express. It's deeply embedded in our way of seeing the world, our habits, our practices, the way we live our lives, the way we build buildings, the way we write literature and think philosophically and construct governments and so on. All of that, Heidegger thinks, is going to be symptomatic of this deep understanding. But it's hard to get at that deep understanding because it's not explicit in our consciousness, in our belief systems, in our values. It pervades all those attitudes. But it's something that's at a much deeper sort of level that's operating tacitly, but therefore all the more powerfully in what we do and how we see things. That's, in a nutshell, the theme, you know, when you're talking about Heidegger and technology, is that deep understanding of the world and of ourselves.
Okay, thanks, Taylor. So, Dan, just to build on Taylor, so technology is obviously all around us, as we've heard from Taylor, and what is it, we all know something about technology. If not, we haven't understood the sort of technological understanding of being, and we only have an implicit understanding of this, according to Heidegger, but we all know something about technology. So I guess, what is it that's sort of distinctive about Heidegger's approach to technology and how he understands this that, you know, maybe gives us in this room some insight here, or that what can Heidegger offer to this understanding or analysis, Dan?
There's a distinction he makes between the essence of technology and technology itself. It's picking up on Taylor's remark about he's not so much interested in those technologies. He is interested in them, but more importantly, the essence of technology. And he repeats that this notion that the essence of technology is nothing technical. He picks up on the old idea that the essence of a tree is not a tree. So the essence of something can't be understood as that in the same way as that which is instantiated or is an example of the essence. Essence is for him a way of being that discloses itself to human beings. And the way it discloses itself is in terms of practices, attitudes, emotions, affectivity. And as Taylor mentions, from about the 19th century on, maybe even a little bit before with when he brings in modern physics into this understanding, Heidegger has this notion of thrownness from his early work, Being and Time. We're thrown into the world. We're thrown into a set of practices, attitudes, ways of understanding things, which allow the world to be disclosed to us. We're the only things to which beings as such are disclosed, but we do it in terms of the traditions into which we've been thrown. And the predominant tradition, a growing tradition that we carry out in our practices and our thinking, is this view that everything is potentially part of this standing reserve, this inventory. There is nothing that can't be utilized for the sake of some kind of utility, and we're implicated in that. We're part of that in two senses, in the sense that everything into which we come contact, we bring this understanding of it as part of this giant, he one time called it the giant gas station, this giant gas station, but also in the sense that we think of ourselves and one another also as part of this standing reserve. But there's something that can't be part of the standing reserve that the standing reserve supposes, and that is this disclosure of what it is. And that, he thinks, is where human beings have a very unique role. Human beings are the site of the disclosure of what it means to be. And he wants to try to get us to understand the essence of technology, not as something technical, to respond directly to your question. Technology is not something we will properly understand if we think of it just instrumentally. It's also not something we will principally understand if we think of it from the standpoint of the human being. We have to think about it from the standpoint of how the world is disclosed to us, what it means to be, which is not in our control. I mean, that's a very bottom line view of Heidegger. Knowledge and truth is something that happens. We can do a lot to bring ourselves to the point where it's disclosed to us, but the disclosure is not something we have control over.
I mean, maybe I just pick up on something here and maybe push you a little bit on the distinction you're making between sort of, just so we're all very clear on it, of technology as sort of an instrument for a purpose, and then potentially the phenomenological analysis of this broader essence or understanding of being. If you could maybe flesh out this distinction between sort of a purposive instrumentalness and then Heidegger's sort of, what is it about phenomenology that allows us to sort of understand this broader background?
Okay, so phenomenology is this study of, historically, the study of the structures and nature and essence of consciousness. So it comes from Edmund Husserl's studies, mostly oriented towards logic and epistemology. What Heidegger does in the early 20s is he's enamored of phenomenology's potential, but he thinks that there's a couple of difficulties with it, and the primary difficulty is that it thinks of human being in the world in terms of knowing, in terms of cognition, and in terms of instrumentality, and that our being in the world is not something that we ever can wield as an instrument, and our being in the world is not primarily a way of knowing. It's actually not an uncommon theme in American pragmatism. Dewey echoes a similar viewpoint when he says traditional philosophers have intellectualized always. Or Dilthey has that famous line, when I read Hume and Kant, I can't believe that blood is flowing through the veins of these thinkers. Because there's a pre-theoretical way of being in the world that in which things are disclosed to us, but it's in advance of adopting a propositional attitude or knowing something explicitly. So Heidegger picks that up from Husserl, that we can step back and take a look at our experiences. Normally, we're so involved in our experiences and so involved in the world that we don't take this orthogonal approach and step back and look at it. And Husserl did that with acts of perception and knowing. And Heidegger says, well, it's important to do that, first of all, with our use of tools. But the seeing of the use of tools is not itself a use of a tool.
That's right.
So the grasping the experience of instrumentality is not itself an instrumentation. So that's the reason he also always will argue that we're not in control of it. I think I'll stop
there. Okay, so we have this sort of understanding that technological sort of mode of being or destiny of being, to use Heidegger's technical term, is just sort of the background that shapes our understanding of the world sort of generally. But we all understand that sort of technology is based on a certain scientific understanding of the world, and we make advancements in sort of physics and biology, and all of a sudden we have new technologies. I was wondering, Trish, if you could say something a little bit about what the connection is between sort of science and technology, or science and technology for Heidegger.
Well, thanks. That's a big question. I'll try and answer it, and I'll try and answer it briefly, keeping in mind that the very last thing that Heidegger wrote that was published was a few months before his death in 1976, when he sent it to DePaul University for an early meeting of the Heidegger Circle, and he asked precisely the question of technology as the question of science. Is science already determined in technology? Is technology already determined by science? What is the relationship between those two things? But to understand why he thinks that the essence of technology and the essence of science are in the end a shared essence, we have to take a step back and look at the history. And of course, the history of the West, which is to say the intellectual history of the West, begins for Heidegger with the Greeks. So Heidegger gives us a kind of once upon a time, which is his story of the West. And in that story, if you look to Aristotle distinguishes physis from techne. And physis is nature, things that emerge of their own accord, versus techne, things that are made by human beings, and they require an artist who has an idea in her or his head, and who then produces the work of art in accord with the idea previously held and now projected onto the material. Of course, as we move the once upon a time into the medieval time, what happens is that conception of nature as what moves of its own accord disappears and is replaced by the Christian conception where nature is a divinely created artifact that comes from the mind of God. So now nature looks a lot more like what Aristotle meant by techne or by technology. So when we come to modernity, Laplace is asked by Napoleon, but where's God in your equations? And Laplace says, God's an unnecessary hypothesis. So we have nature from which its capacity to move itself, in other words, its own teleology, in which things move towards a purpose, a goal, an end, in the way that an acorn moves towards an oak tree, that has been lost in favor of the idea that it's in the mind of God. But now God is dead. So after God is dead, nature becomes nothing more than material, or as Marx would have called it, the material forces of production, hanging around as a standing reserve that can be appropriated towards human purposes. And as you can see, that would be a great recipe for environmental destruction, because nature serves no more function than to be available for human disposition according to the human purpose. So historically, science appears to come before the essence of technology that determines, and I'm not going to say our experience, because we is a very problematic term. Do I mean we here in this room? Do I mean we British, because I was born in Scotland? Do I mean we of the global north? I mostly, pretty much in the context here of talking about Heidegger and technology, mean we of the global north. So Heidegger's West stands now in opposition to the global south, which is to say, in some sense, the contemporary problem of technology is simply a confusion of geography. And in fact, though science appears to come before technology, it can only do that and thereby be the herald of technology, because the essence of technology, i.e. nature, consists in nothing more than what human being can project onto nature, foretells the technological, as he calls it, the global conquest of the earth by technology. Is that too long?
No, I think that's fine. So Trish was just talking a little bit about the danger, and she's sort of alluding to this sort of distinction between sort of the global north and the global south, and Heidegger himself thought there might be some dangers to modern technology and our technological sort of use or potentially abuse of the natural world. But Beck, could you say a bit more about sort of the dangers of modern technology as Heidegger understands it, or potentially more generally?
It's two ways to go. Heidegger understands those dangers in fairly specific ways, and then it becomes fairly unspecific and very, very, very complicated. The dangers that he sees really grow out of some of the answers that have already been given. I think Taylor already began by making good mention of those. Those dangers are the tendency to fall into a technological way of thinking and to think that the solution will be, we see this always, more and more technology. We left out, at least for me, some key aspect in the notion of Bestand, which is very, very important, of resource focus, and Trish's reference to resource is very important there. But we left out this really problematic word that is, although it is this setup or enframing word that is translated, very hard to translate, Gestell. And what Heidegger thinks is that there's a seductive aspect to the Gestell, because everything is for this, which is for that, which is for something else. And one of the things that Heidegger suggests, and I really liked what Dan was saying about this throne quality, because it does seem to be that there's a legacy, that there's tradition. And Heidegger has this beautiful discussion of the Forstwart, you know, the Holz, the woodworker, the forest management person, the person who manages what trees should be cut and what trees should not be cut. And he's in the Black Forest full of trees. And after the war, when he's writing this, this is very much a matter of rebuilding Germany. So trees are going to fall. And then the question is, how are they going to fall? And one of the things he looks at and the danger that he sees there is the thinking that the same woodsman takes the same care with the wood that his grandfather did, and so that he's really in that same throne trajectory. And for Heidegger, and maybe that's not really fully up to us, but in any case, I think it is in a certain sense built into the Gestell, there is not just the looking for the wood. There's also the full context and the purpose for which wood is going to be used for actually the printing of leaflets for the most part, which is an interesting thing because the real obvious answer would be, well, Germany's going to be building houses because we kind of smashed them to smithereens and so they need that. But that is not one of the things that was used for it. And for Heidegger, that's really what the Gestell is. So they're ordering to another purpose which has another purpose. So all of these industries are interlocking and the purposes are interlocking. And that's where Heidegger comes into it to say, in the midst of all of that, we're going to be seeing almost everything as a what for or other possibility. And that's one of the reasons why folks will often say, oh, come along, be post-human, be transhuman. But from a Heideggerian perspective, the slight danger with that is that that's the human being. As again, so much bestand, so much stock, we can remake ourselves, rework ourselves. So we become, and for Heidegger, that's the great danger, that we put ourselves into that same ordering possibility. We've exhausted the things that we can do, perhaps with the natural world, and we're perfectly happy to turn it upon ourselves and fit ourselves into the same structure and then see what else can follow from that. That's the particular danger. Everything that Dan was saying for Heidegger is the greatest danger in Heidegger's own mind, that it will be lost to us to even catch sight of the fact that there's maybe a something beyond us which isn't in our control. Why? Because it's completely seductive. All that we can do and the fact that what we set up sets up a juggernaut of effects and consequences, which is sort of, you know, like a Rube Goldberg machine, so that once it begins going, there's really no way to stop it. That, there's a whole, it's overdetermined in so many ways why we can't get out of some of the things that he's going to call a danger. It's not a matter of, am I against technology? Am I for technology? It's a matter of an extraordinary complexity built into Gestell, which is itself locked into other Gestell. One of the things that you can miss with Heidegger is that his big example, easiest to start, is mountain ranges. So not a mountain, etc., but mountain ranges, and that means the folds of the earth. This extraordinary geological metaphor. This is folded, folded against that, and that's folded. And then there's this great tectonic possibility. So it's a very complicated thing, this Gestell, and we can't really render it with enframing, because enframing misses that whole structure of interlocking parts, you know, maybe Lego, but Lego misses the underlying shifts, you know, of mountains as they move. Yeah. But, okay.
One of the things you were talking about is that it's a danger almost for us. The idea, it seems to be that in the age of technology, not only do we treat the world as resources, but we ourselves become resources, human resources. There's something sort of missing about us, or we're used and abused. Trish, do you want to say maybe something about this or some more about the dangers of modern technology?
Yeah. I think people have always been resources, so I don't know that I see something particularly new in the invention of human resources is the way we manage our personnel. What I think is most threatening and most a danger of technology is that it puts itself forward as the only truth. So science and technology, which I've already suggested to you, are actually collapsed in modernity because what Aristotle meant by science, the study of physis, of ta physica, no longer really exists for us. Nature is just that upon which human being can project a representation. So if that's the case, then when one form of knowledge or one knowledge system suggests that it is the only legitimate knowledge system, that it sets the ontological and epistemological standard, you run into all kinds of problems because it brings with it a political component. So it means that, you know, as my son, who when he was 5 was asked if he was going to be a doctor, he said no, and the person said why not, and he said because I don't have a white coat. So, you know, having a white coat, having a lab, publishing in peer-reviewed journals, these are the things that make what you say knowledge. On the other hand, if you are a woman in India who goes into a hut with several other women at the beginning of the rainy season and plants seeds you saved from last year in San samples of dirt that you collected from different areas where you grow your crop, and after 30 days come out and say, we will plant these seeds in that field and these seeds in that field, because you know, and you have just tested, you have just seen which seeds grow well in which soil, which is in which fields, that doesn't actually count as knowledge. What counts as knowledge is some scientists who got a grant from the NSF who determined that eucalyptus will give you the most amount of leaf in return for the least amount of water put into it. Well, that's true when eucalyptus is this big. When eucalyptus is this big, it'll give you the least amount of leaf for the most amount of water to put into it. Now you've sucked out your water table, the community is now hungry and they are thirsty. A community is destroyed by that kind of scientific green revolution, technology transfer to the global south. Whereas what those women's, and it's not trivial to say women's here, because the Gestell of technology is an inherently patriarchal, which is to say, in the phallic order Gestell. And we can talk about technology as if it's just a metaphysics, as if the doctor, which is to say the metaphysician of Heidegger, has diagnosed this problem for us. There's a whole context of power and global destruction that, you know, so what will happen? What will the outcome be of this danger? The outcome of this danger, you would think, would be, well, we should fix ourselves. We should free ourselves from this addiction of technology. We should figure out how to have a free relationship with technology. I suggest that is not possible for the culture of the global north. I suggest a new beginning that has a new understanding of being, which is to say a new understanding of nature and a new understanding of human being, can only come from the global south, from places that are both inside technology as it stands now as this global overrunning of global capital, but also outside, because I'm talking about subsistence economies, economies that don't draw a straight line from the field to profit that can be exported and sold in another country. They draw a circle, and in that circle, the farmer simply stands as a mediator, as a part of the cycle of water comes down and the crop emerges of its own accord. So a good farmer doesn't flood in pesticides and fertilizers because technology tells us we can control nature. It simply sets the conditions and then sits back and allows Fuzes to do its work such that nature can emerge of its own accord. So now we have a circle of water going into the ground, coming up as rain, and the farmer managing that circle by respecting nature and allowing it to emerge. And I suggest that that's not just a change in the way that we of the global north can think, but it's a change to another knowledge system, which is a more gender-balanced knowledge system, and also a knowledge system that can allow the inclusion of other voices. So I think there's a whole political context for the Heideggerian critique of technology that I know we don't have an infinite amount of time, and therefore I have pushed us.
Yeah. Well, I mean, well, we will actually get back to the political connection and the connection you see between technology and potentially global capitalism. But I'm going to let Taylor jump in now and see if does Heidegger have anything sort of to say about what can release us or potentially save us from the ills of technology? And is there a positive way to sort of see and use technology? I mean, technology, as I think many of you here realize, you appreciate your smartphone, you appreciate all that technology has in a way done to enhance human life, whether it's in the medical sciences or travel or things like this. There seems to be something positive about technology. So I was wondering if, Taylor, you can say something about what's positive and potentially what saves us, if there is anything to be saved.
So I think, again, it's really important to keep in mind what Dan mentioned earlier on, which is this idea of thrownness. We're thrown into our understanding of the world. That's what say we find ourselves with it already. Heidegger liked this expression, always already. We're always already in the world. We're always already in some mood or other. Things are showing up as mattering in a certain way and making sense in a certain way. And with these historically different understandings of being, you just are born into it and you find yourself with it. So I think it's not quite right to say that the danger of technology is the danger that we'll slip into a technological understanding of things. We've got it already. We're in it. We're swimming in it. It's ubiquitous in our way of seeing the world. And the thing that's important, too, about distinguishing the essence of technology, which is sometimes what he just means when he says technology, from technology meaning the devices and instruments, is that it's easy to think that we're in control of the instruments. And Heidegger even says that's correct. But the danger of thinking of technology as identical with the technological devices and instruments is the danger of supposing that because we control the instruments, we also control the technological understanding of being that we find ourselves with. And again, as Dan said, we do not control that. That's not manipulable. That's not a tool. And the danger of thinking that we're in control of everything, including how we see the world, is that we will not be responsive to the understanding we find ourselves with. It'll be invisible to us because we think anything that's real is manipulable. So it won't even occur to us that there is this way for things to show up and to make sense and to matter. So I think the danger that he sees in technology or in the technological understanding of being is, just as Trish said, that it will seem so obvious, so transparent, that it won't even occur, doesn't even occur to us that there are fundamentally different ways of seeing and making sense of and understanding the world. It'll be invisible. So the danger is that the technological understanding of being just occludes every other possible understanding of being. The others don't even just show up. That's very important. Now, I think it's also important to say that Heidegger is very careful not to make easy moralistic value judgments about technology being good or bad. It's nothing good or bad. The devices certainly by themselves are nothing good or bad, and it's easy to think that because you think, well, it all depends on what use we make of them, right? But he also doesn't think that there's anything bad about the technological understanding of being. It's a little bit like what Foucault said when somebody asked Foucault, does he think that disciplinary power is bad? And he said, no, I think it's dangerous. It's not the same thing, right? So it's dangerous precisely because it's invisible. We're in its grip precisely because we're not aware of it. We're not attuned to its contingency, that it's one way of seeing the world and not others. And I think that what Heidegger wants to say is that the way to see beyond it somehow, or to be sensitive or responsive to the other possible ways for the world to be disclosed, is just to recognize that the technological understanding of being is an understanding of being, that it is the way things show up for us always already. And that means to say, to be attuned to the fact that we're attuned to the world that way. So it really requires a kind of cultivation of a sort of responsiveness or attunement. The more you think technology is a problem that we have to fix, the more you are in the grip of the technological understanding of being, right? So he's careful not to make, as I say, sort of glib value judgments about the goodness or badness of technology, and he's also very careful not to offer easy sort of prescriptions and solutions, like let's do this or let's do that or here's the direction we should take. He says almost nothing in that regard, in fact. What he does say is that once you see the dangerousness of the technological understanding of being in its pervasiveness in the way we understand ourselves in the world, once you are attuned to that, you'll get a sense of its uncanniness and its strangeness, and that will already make you responsive to other possible ways of seeing the world. But again, it's important to emphasize that, as Dan said, you are not in control of how the world is going to show up for you. And as there's nothing bad about, intrinsically bad about the technological understanding of being, it's not bad to have the technological understanding of being as long as you are attuned to it as one contingent way for things to show up. So when Heidegger writes this essay on the question concerning technology, the very first thing he says that his goal is to understand the essence of technology so that we could imagine a gaining a free relation to it. And I want to just emphasize that does not mean getting out of it. It means having a free relation to it, that's to say being attuned to it. The danger of it is that if you're not attuned to it, it seems obvious and it's everywhere and it doesn't even occur to you that there's a different way to understand things. That's how I would put it. But no easy prescriptions of like, here's the problems with technology and here's some possible solutions. That would be a total misunderstanding of his point, I think.
I want to push you a little bit on this, actually, Taylor. Just that Heidegger has had an influence on deep ecology And it seems that there are some things we can say that are dangerous in a concrete term. It's not just that we fail to recognize that technology kind of governs the general way we see the world, but there seems to be that it leads to something, some way Heidegger puts it would be, or not necessarily that Heidegger puts it, but one way to understand the way he's putting it is it results in environmental degradation, humanity's homelessness, he sometimes talks about, and also potentially difficult to understand, but a loss of the sacred or the loss of the gods.
So this seems something
That there are these more concrete potential problems. Do you want to say maybe just a few words about
this? Well, that's certainly true, right? And I don't deny it, and Heidegger wouldn't deny it. It's all to the good that we can imagine something other than the knee-jerk technological response to problems, including environmental destruction and degradation of nature and so on. That's all to the good. I really think it's not the main point he was making, though. I really think the main point he was making was to say that what's important is cultivating a responsiveness to other ways in which things can show up. I don't think it's obvious that Heidegger was thinking about technology because he wanted to improve the world. I don't think that's obvious. I think he was thinking about technology because he was worried about the dominance of one way of seeing all the nature of all entities, the uniformity, the monopoly that it had on the way things are uncovered. And again, I think the danger of thinking that he's trying to imagine ways to improve life or improve the world to make things better is that once you put it that way, it starts sounding like a technical problem that can have a technical solution. And that's just the frame of thinking that he's trying to point out seems obvious to us. Right, that's already symptomatic of this technological understanding. But again, nothing bad about the technological understanding. In fact, I think a lot of ways of improving our relation to the environment will be technological. I mean, there's nothing bad about technical solutions to technical problems. watering the eucalyptus trees in the right way so that you get, you know, you don't screw it up. That's good. But I really think whether there can be anything sacred cuts much deeper into challenging our common sense, because a certain technologically developed understanding of the world for a technological understanding of the world, that will come to not even really make any sense. That will seem like an outdated vocabulary, a concept we just don't or can't use anymore. It'll seem quaint or archaic or alien to us. And I think that's worth thinking about, and that's what Heidegger was saying, I think.
I know that some of our other panelists disagree with Taylor on this, and I think we'll get to that in a little bit. But, Dan, I wanted to ask you this potentially sensitive or tricky or difficult question. Is there any sort of connection between sort of Heidegger's work on technology and his sort of involvement with National Socialism in the...
Somebody was going to get this question.
Yeah.
this guy. Before I do, let me just add a couple things that underscore what's been said by Taylor and Babette and Trish. In the question concerning technology, as an alternative to technology, he suggests the possibility of art. So that's one. He's already thinking of this free relationship of another way to think of how things are disclosed as art. And in The Origin of the Work of Art, he says that art has this capacity to reveal that there's something we can't make completely unhidden, the so-called earth. Something that continually recedes from view. So he's already thinking of alternatives there, and I think that's clearly what he means in part by the free relation. What Trish said about science and technology is a really strong theme in Heidegger, and I don't think it's an accident that Leo Strauss was in his seminars. So the idea that nature is in the service of human beings, and that modern science is aimed at that, the mastery of nature. That's Descartes' discourse on method, where he talks about a reason as a tool, essentially, and then in Bacon and Hobbes. This way of thinking of reason as purely instrumental is part of their way of the ways in which they developed science in such a way that it is in some deep relationship to the development of modern technology. That also goes hand in hand with the elimination of discussion of final causes, formal causes, and so on, constitutive causes in terms of just mechanisms that you can control. National socialism. This is a tough question, but maybe we should go back to a liberal thinker who's probably in the background of Heidegger here. He made a famous claim that Germany is a possible third way. And I think German intellectuals thought that they were possibly a third way. But what are the other two ways? Capitalism, world markets, complete control of the markets, complete control of all commodities, all resources in terms of the markets. That's capitalism. What's the other possibility? Socialism, complete control of the powers of production, consumption, and distribution organized from the top. There's got to be a third way. There's got to be some other possibility than capitalism, world markets, and the kind of socialism that he was seeing developed. He voted a different kind of socialist, as we know. Now, before he voted for the socialists, he voted for workers' parties, peasant parties, excuse me, and they had a strong environmental component to them. And there was a part of the National Socialism movement in the early 30s, particularly the SA, that also was very strong about environmental issues. So Heidegger, I don't think that's the complete motivation, but part of the motivation is this idea that there must be another way, seeing that some of the National Socialists were supporting environmental policies, that led him to this famous, infamous statement, the innere Größe und Würde, the inner greatness and dignity of National Socialism, something that he reintroduced into the Introduction to Metaphysics in 1953, I think, but spelling N, National, and Socialism with a small N and a small S, but still talking about its inner dignity and greatness. Now, he was accused by party officials in 34. Well, you got your own private kind of National Socialism here. This doesn't look like anything we're doing. And there was this disaffection that led in part to their resignation, but never the full public rebuke of National Socialism. But I do think it goes hand in hand. I think it's clear that if we can believe the volumes from 36 to 40, he begins to place National Socialism together with American capitalism and Bolshevik socialism. And then he adds, and we Germans are the worst. So he saw National Socialism as giving up this promise, at least the party in power, giving up this promise that he once had put all his faith into. There's no doubt that he had this enamored view of the possibilities of National Socialism in the 1933, adopting his own philosophical terminology to the support of the party.
So in a way, he saw sort of National Socialism as an example of Gestell, of the all-enframing power of technology.
Yeah. And in the Schwarze Hefte, he adds world Jewry.
Yeah.
So that's why the Schwarze Hefte are so scandalous now, because until those, I think it's 41, 42, we didn't have the statements that added this fourth component. So originally it was the Weberian idea, an alternative to capitalism and socialism, the two ideas of being able to completely mastermind things, he thought. There must be a third way. Disappointed with National Socialism, he includes it in the list, and then he does add the some kind of international jewelry.
Just quickly, he was of the folkish nationalist, down-to-earth, blood-and-soil kind of romantic National Socialism. But in being in that part of, as it were, socialistic socialism, he was against the heavily industrialized sort of part of the party that took over after the Night of Long Knives in 34. But his anti-Semitism goes along with that distrust of industry, capitalism, and so on. So he was the anti-Semitism pragmatism is what is now more obvious than ever, but it's part of his identifying with a certain part of the party that really lost ground in 34. But he was an admirer of Hitler. He was an anti-Semite. He was an enthusiastic Nazi. There's no denying it. Yeah.
So maybe you have a difficult question here, Trish, and that's after talking about Heidegger's kind of involvement or commitment to National Socialism, is there sort of a positive moral, political, environmental message or something to be taken from Heidegger's philosophy and his work on technology? As I mentioned before, deep ecologists are really sort of into Heidegger, and they think there's something very important to be found here. But is there some positive way to take Heidegger's work on technology?
I actually was going to raise the question of deep ecologists, but I was wondering, are there any deep ecologists here?
Shallow ecologists?
So I don't know if people are interested so much in the idea of deep ecologists. I mean, there's been a big debate about Heidegger and deep ecology and Heidegger and environmental issues that's been played out in the journal Environmental Ethics, but also in other places. And really, in essence, the deep ecological position is that nature doesn't just have instrumental value, it has value of its own. It has inherent value, which speaks a bit to what I said earlier about Aristotle. Understanding nature is not just available for human consumption, but nature is having its own purposes and its own goals when the acorn grows into an oak tree as opposed to, say, a Porsche. And, you know, there are, that nature, everything in nature has a telos, and it moves itself towards it. But as long as you still have that word value, you always already, because I like that phrase too, Imogen, co-opted into the essence of technology as this mindset. So in some sense, for, you know, deep ecologists, it's like, let's stop cutting down the forest. But then it just becomes, you know, instead of being so many board feet of lumber, now it's a place you can go to consume it as an aesthetic of your vacation. So you haven't actually disrupted the essence of technology. And so how do you? I mean, I guess I'm a pessimist, but I'm an optimistic pessimist, because I think that there can be another opening and there can be another beginning. But I think that the idea that the global North. I mean, look at how hopeless we have been at managing climate change. If you want to have an instance of something that's completely outside of human control, that has been created, that human being in by, you know, the people who work on climate change, our global leaders have been so ineffective in responding to the question of climate change. Why is that? Because they're always already co-opted by capital. How can we disrupt that? Not from within capital. So there are places, there are pockets that are other ways of understanding economy. Because what is economy? It's the nomos, the law of the oikos, of the home. If you think what it means to have the law for home, where home means management of the planet, because we really each have two homes. The first home you have is the womb of the mother. The second home you have is nature. It's not essential to the human condition to be homeless, to be experience things that are uncanny, that we have already spoken of. That belongs particularly to modernity as an epoch in the history of the global North or the West.
So technology makes us homeless.
Because it makes us homeless in nature. Because nature is not a dwelling now. It's not a home. It's simply resources, material forces of production that can be liquidated to meet human needs. Dwelling, it has a very different understanding and a very different relationship towards nature. I'm really, you know, we all live in the United States. I'm really nervous of any discourse of religion and sacrality, because so much baggage comes with that. But I would prefer to talk about something like mystery. That it is not the case that soon all will be known, which is the Apollinean promise that we've been living with, that science will figure it all out. There is mystery, and mystery is something to be honored and cherished, because in the end, that's the mystery is the mystery of nature, but it's also the mystery of that first home. How is it life? How does that happen? To quote Anna DeFranco, you think you have power because you control the weapons of death. I can make life. I can make breath. You want to explain that to me now? It's a mystery, and to focus on that can be a starting point. But that, you know, what changes now? Everything changes and nothing changes. And I think you have to be very careful. At the beginning of the Fragmentarische Technik, Heidegger is precise. Technology is never neutral. He doesn't say, oh, well, it's not good, it's not. He says it's never neutral. And I think he is extremely critical of the consequences. What happens to the Rhine when you put a power plant on it? Something, right? So I think to ferret out the places where he is critical of technology, and he does offer us alternatives. They're slightly idealistic, and they involve Van Gogh paintings and shoes and the idealization of the life of the peasant. And thank you to Via Campesina, but the life of the peasant is really hard, and Brutus in short. So,
but this idea of dwelling is important as a response.
Absolutely.
Babette, do you want to maybe add a bit to what Trish is saying about sort of like the home and the potential sort of like saving positive aspects that we have maybe in this notion of sort of Gelassenheit from technology or a releasement from technology? Or is there a positive story, or are you skeptical about this?
I'm a little bit skeptical about that, and I'm skeptical about it because I'm not sure that one can translate Gelassenheit as releasing. So for me, that's a little bit, you know, it's already getting there too fast where we want to go. That's reading into it. And one of the things that maybe we left out a bit was the first point in the question concerning technology, and that's the question. One of the things that has always stayed with me, you think, hey, it's the question concerning technology in German, die Frage nach, and that really means the question after, in the wake of, what's the state of the question? Heidegger's got this big obsession with questioning. He's one of the few philosophers to think a lot about that in a methodological way. And that is done so quickly. It's done at the beginning of Being in Time, of course. But it also comes back, and this whole way of concluding doesn't interest us. Questioning is the piety of thought. We're not interested in that because we want to talk about piety. We want perhaps to talk about thought. But we really get past that question of questioning, because one of the problems with questioning, it's like the question about thinking, is that we're not doing it. And really questioning, to really question, especially for academics, is hard because we already know the answer. And so what happens to questioning with technology is that we're really not doing it. The experts are already ready. They've got a way. They've got proposals. There's money to be had. They can tell you how to spend it. And that, for me, is one of the reasons why I'm not really able to look at Heidegger showing us how to be released from technology. I think maybe a Buddhist monk can tell you that better. So for me, there is something else that he's really trying to get at with this notion of Gelassenheit. But Gelassenheit itself is follows from everything that everyone around with all of our disagreements, everything that we've said, and that is this: really, anything that you think you're going to be doing to control it, including being aware of it. Because I've never met anyone who uses technology who doesn't think that they're fully aware of it. They will say, I know. And if I let them, they'll tell me their strategy for controlling it. You know, their cell phone, maybe they don't have one, or their email, maybe they only check certain hours of a day, or any of the things that we do. But that's the problem with technology, is that it, even if we don't use it, and Heidegger's most devastating point is, you go away from it, and it really has you. And that's something that during Hurricane Katrina really hit everyone in New York very, very forcefully. And that was, the only thing people wanted was not really, you know, sandwiches, but places to plug in their cell phones. And my students as well, because they had job, they had work, because New York being where it's located, not every spot was hit by that. Some places are lower. They were flooded. One knows that in England, in the lowlands, where things are flooded. And where things are not flooded, where I'm in the Heights, I had no idea. And so it's a completely different thing, and things proceeded as usual. So the problem is a certain blindness, and getting perspicuity that one would want really overlooks the fact that what you really are also aware of, and that's the hermeneutic. I mean, that's what I would add to the question of Heidegger, and that Heidegger brings to phenomenology, is this You know that you've got this access. You know that if you could only get onto email, then everything would be fine. And in the middle of a hurricane, that could be your thought, tells us how far we've gone. So there is... So is there saving to that? I don't know. Maybe you could pop people on the head and say, think of something else besides getting on email.
Right.
But I'm on email, so...
Yeah. Well, maybe I'll ask you just about that, because... not about you being on email, but the...
I'm on email.
Yeah. But, I mean, Heidegger was writing his writings on technology sort of informed his thinking in the 40s, 50s, he didn't, although he saw the television and the airplane and these sorts of things, he wasn't aware of Facebook or the internet or these kinds of things. Is there something that Heidegger could either tell us about this, or what would Heidegger sort of say about these things, Instagram, and is there a bad... I mean,
he does say quite a bit about that, because I think we have this notion that we've invented this rather recently, and we haven't. We haven't. There is the crystallization of opinion by Freud's nephew, Bernays, and that is something that is really an American invention to a certain extent, but the way it works is through media. We just add the word social and think that we've got something altogether new. For Heidegger, what you're really manipulating by cutting down those trees that I mentioned is the way that we should think. And that is like Vannevar Bush's, in the United States, is our Bush guy, 1945, beautiful publication, As We May Think. And it's all about making sure that everyone can have one of these. It's a very, very important determination, if you like, of the dissemination of technology in all kinds of ways. Heidegger thought that the most important thing would be to control the opinion of people. And that's what he writes about in The Question Concerning Technology. It's not in an esoteric document. It's not in the black notebooks. It's right there in The Question Concerning Technology. Dan wants to get it.
Yeah, just want to add to that. There is one thing he takes over from Husserl in Phenomenology, and so I know that's a little esoteric, but it's a very simple idea, and that is, if you want to understand your own consciousness or experience, from a phenomenological point of view, no one else can do it for you. So Husserl has this notion, he says in one of his books, that the fundamental methodological move for a phenomenologist is reflection. But you have to reflect on your own experiences, because no one else can do that for you. It's a first personal experience. And Heidegger's notion of authenticity in being in time, and I think also later, it's a richer notion than it is in being in time in some ways, but he's calling attention to the fact that we have to take responsibility for this ourselves. Now, we have all kinds of problems with Heidegger, the individual, the man, in lots of ways, but that was a constant call of his thinking. And I think that also applies to the question concerning technology. It's a call to do this on your own. I mean, no one else can do it for you. And one other point that, I don't know, it's maybe just really simple-minded, but is somebody not wearing a left sock? Oh, you aren't. Okay. Well, you messed my that's, you're the fly in my ointment. Socks are implements. They're tools. What in this room is not a tool? I mean, it's just the ubiquity, the everydayness, the sense in which we're suffused by using things. And these things are not given just by nature. They require somebody to put them in a position where we can use them. And Heidegger has a very deep sense of that from very early on. And what Trish said is vital. He was, from 1921 to 28 or so, he couldn't stop reading Aristotle. Aristotle's fundamental distinction between the natural and the artificial. The natural has its principle of rest and motion within it. But the artificial gets its principle of rest and motion from without. One of the great problems he saw in Western thinking is, as Trish put it, the blurring of this. We can't tell the difference anymore between the natural and the artificial. Right? There's some deep problems there about the nature of causation, the nature of forces, and so on. But this extent to which we are technological beings is something that he grasped, and he saw the difficulty of it, not with solutions to everything, but certainly a deep understanding of that issue.
Taylor wanted in on this.
Quickly, about if the question is about Facebook and Twitter and all this, it seems to me that the examples just keep getting better and better for Heidegger. The reason I think this essay that he wrote, The Question Concerning Technology in 1953-54, it was so prescient is because with technological advances, it fits his description so much better and better, right? Because what is characteristic of Bestand, or standing reserve, the resource material, is its flexibility, its adaptability to multiple purposes. So styrofoam, particle board, the stuff which you can use for anything, right? And the most flexible sort of Bestand imaginable is information. So he mentioned cybernetics once. I think, was it in the Spiegel interview? Yeah. They were asking him what would replace philosophy.
Thing in 647.
So it was on his radar screen a bit, but if he had lived longer to see the sort of computer revolution and all this sort of stuff, it would have been perfect, because what is the most flexible, useful, clean resource material? Information, right? But so I think it seems to me our world is even more technological than the world Heidegger was living in. It even better fits his description of Bestand and Gestell. But again, like, suppose we got perfectly clean energy sources, you know, and is completely renewable and lovely. I mean, Heidegger says somewhere something like, if we could solve all of our problems technologically, right, cure diseases, increase longevity, and clean the environment, that would be the darkest night, right? So it's important to remember that Heidegger was not exactly politically correct about this, right? I mean, he was interested in something not so obviously practical about the tenacity of this way of seeing things as technical problems and solutions. That's really what I think is the takeaway.
Okay, I'll give Dan the last word, and then we'll take questions from the audience.
When Taylor was mentioning this, there's an interview in 1968, I'm sure it's on YouTube, where they're interviewing Heidegger, and he says, who knows in what biology lab somewhere, they're in a test tube producing human beings. 1968. He's worried about cloning.
Trish will get the last word she wanted.
Well, I was going to add much along those lines that I think there's perhaps something fundamentally different when you're messing about with genes, whether it's gene therapy, genetically modified organisms, the capacity to do, you know, pre-implantation sex selection so you can decide if you want your baby to be a boy or a girl, and if you want it to be blonde and blue-eyed. Perhaps that's not the best example in this context, right? Those kinds of choices. Is there something fundamentally different about that capacity to intervene through biology that happens now that wasn't happening in the same way in Heidegger's time? Does that change the game so it's not just more of the same and we can run the same Heideggerian arguments, but we actually have to think the question, as Babette put it, in a new and perhaps deeper way now that we have technologies that are intervening at the very basic level of human life?
Please join me in thanking the panelists. And as Beth said, if you have a question, just put your hand up. She'll bring the mic over, and please talk into the mic so it's recorded for the podcast.
Is there any way of turning this off, by the way, the light from the projector? Is that possible? Because it's just a little...
It makes you very attractive, though.
I'm always attractive.
I'm a little more than you.
That's nice.
This gentleman here.
And there was a question very much at the back, too.
If you could just keep your hand up, and I'll try and put that
Is it on? Yeah. Just wanted to ask you a question. It seems to me that the crucial point for Heidegger is thrownness, as you said. Isn't it to say, when it comes to technology, he wants to say, we've been thrown once into the world, let's not be thrown again into technology without any intention. I mean, what I'm trying to say, that probably he was trying to say that not to be led by technology, be in control of technology rather than let it take us.
Or perhaps
using it for the sake of having it, because I'm using Facebook now because if I don't use it, I think that I'm behind everyone else. It's there, let's use it.
Yeah. There's something right about that, but it's important to know that thrownness wasn't just the event of my birth at the beginning of my life. We're always thrown into the world. So thrownness is something that's perpetual throughout your life. And it just means that you find yourself in a situation that's, again, always already constituted and going, that you have to keep coping with. So I don't think he's resisting the idea of being thrown into the world. I think he wants to say you have to embrace it and be attuned to it and responsive to it. And again, it's a metaphor, the thrownness, so we can't take it too literally. But what reveals your thrownness into the world is your mood, the way you're attuned to things. And what he's trying to cultivate is an attunement to this technological understanding, and absolutely not pushing it away. He's not a Luddite, right? He says the worst thing, not the worst, I don't know if he says it's the worst thing, but it's definitely what we should not do is try and push technology away, call it the work of the devil, and try and have nothing to do with it. That you'd be totally in its grip if that's your attitude towards it. So in fact, what he wants you to do is, in a certain sense, embrace and be responsive to our technological understanding of being, to see that that's what it is, to see it's been given to us as a gift. That's the irony of the camp.
To say that we've already been thrown, let's deal with it now.
Well, yeah, that's right. Let's face up to it and not think it's something we can accept or reject, because that's what we can't really do. Yeah.
Okay. Great, thank you. I was wondering, Ted, if I could just press you on this issue of monopoly and tenacity.
Yeah.
So suppose we are in this situation, we don't realize that this is only one of many possible ways of disclosure. Someone might ask, why would that be so concerning? So, I mean, one possible answer would be a kind of million marketplace of ideas. We need lots of competition but it doesn't seem like that's the story, right?
Right.
Another worry might be, well, it's just kind of ignorant and philosophically bad not to realize this. But then, you know, you could have people who say, well, I don't really care about philosophy, or I've got other kind of goals in mind. And I guess what flagged this for you is the comparison you draw with Foucault, because, you know, of course, as you know better than I, there's this long discussion, particularly in the late interviews, where people say to Foucault, you know, what's bad about this? You know, what are you worried about is being undermined? And he seems to have some very complex, very interesting picture of what is threatened by these developments. And I guess, what do you think Heidegger thinks is threatened?
Good. Yes, so his answer would be different from Foucault's. Foucault, who is more of a Nietzschean, said, you know, we need to be aware of what he called power so that we can imagine other possibilities. Foucault was more like Nietzsche in thinking the good option would be a flourishing of other possibilities. And I did make it sound that way when I talked about the monopoly. But Heidegger's answer to your question, I think, would be the real danger is not being attuned to the fact that we are the entity for whom a world is opened up and disclosed somehow. That's what the technological understanding of being is sort of ill-equipped to recognize. So you're quite right to press me on this, because it's not just that it's too bad that we only have this one understanding of being when we could have a bunch of others. That's not wrong, but I think what he thinks is really threatened is that when you don't even acknowledge that there can be other understandings of being, other possible ones in the future, as there have been in the past, what you're really missing is this very uncanny fact that things show up at all for us in any particular way, and that's something mysterious, as Trish said. I think that's exactly the right word. It's enigmatic. It's not manipulable. It's not controllable. It's unfathomable. But it's also something that I think it's not wrong to call sacred. And I think he wants us to be attuned to that. So really, the short answer, why should we care about the technological understanding gaining this monopoly on our understanding of everything? It's why should we care about this disclosedness of the world? It's because that's what we are, is world disclosers. I think it's anchored in our being. And I think that's the best thing I can think of to say about why it should matter to us.
So Trish wants to add something in response. And then the woman with the black hair in the back, yes.
It's not life-affirming. You know, Babette studied biology. She stopped because she didn't want to have to guillotine the hamsters. Science requires that its object is fixed and dead. What happens to butterflies? People love butterflies so much they stick them on a pin, right? Science is not a life-affirming practice. Or technology, the essence of technology, is not a life-affirming way of dwelling.
I'd, Is it working? I don't know if there are any flat ontologists in the room. I'm not one of them, but I'm quite interested in the idea of understanding the world and kind of trying to walk away from correlationism and kind of understanding nature as a construct. And I'm just wondering, what do you think Heidegger would think about the ideas of flat ontology and object-oriented ontology? And
oh, boy.
Can you, what was it? What
flat,
was
you're talking about Measu, and you're referring to Measu's work?
Well,
and Gabriel, Graham Harman and Gabriel, and so on. Yeah, yeah. That's a big question.
Oh, can you just repeat it again quickly, please? Some of the panelists didn't hear.
I'm just wondering, what do you think Heidegger would think about the ideas of flat ontologists or object-oriented ontologists who walk away from correlationism and anthropocentrism and try to think about the world as hyper-object and us living within an object and nature being a construct and kind of okay, which has ceased itself? Yeah. How Heidegger would take on that?
Realism,
gotcha, gotcha. Speculative realism.
So Heidegger thinks that to a great extent, there's some exceptions to it, that the notion of object is a modern philosophical term, that the Greeks didn't have a notion of object. They had a notion of ousia, or however that's translated. And even in the medievals, the word objectum, when it's used, it isn't used in the sense of the object over against the subject. So I think Heidegger, one of Heidegger's themes in his later work and tries to impress on us is the distinction between the difference between a thing, an object, a work. So I think that he would be suspicious, to say the least, about a universalization of objectivity, objecthood, even in this hyper sense. It may even be for him. He talks about the end of metaphysics, the need for going beyond metaphysics, that this would be a fallback into that. He stops using the word ontology, by the way, in he says explicitly, I can't use this term anymore, in the Introduction to Metaphysics is 1936. There has to be a way of thinking about what it means to be that doesn't fall into the trope of thinking of what it means to be in terms of objecthood. So I think that would be one answer. There are different, this gets right into things that we've talked about, that Trish has talked about. There must be other ways in which we experience the world than as subjects over against objects. And he is very sensitive to trying to exploit those ways. And some of his resources for that are poets. He thinks that poets, this obviously famous theme from Rilke and so on in the 20th century, that the loss of things was a commonly felt dilemma in the mid-20th century for many poets. And he picks up on that. The notion of the sacred, the word Geheimnis, mystery, comes from a home. There is a kind of loss of home with the movement from agrarian to urban settings. And that's also a loss of mystery. So I think these are all different kinds of experiences that he thinks are flattened out by this, any kind of objectivization by ontology.
Okay, Taylor wanted to add a little bit to
Dan. Just a really little bit, because we're running out of time. But I don't think Heidegger is a correlationist. So that term is used to describe the phenomenological tradition, and I think it's fair about Husserl and Merleau-Ponty, but Heidegger actually was a kind of realist about physical nature. I think he thought it exists independently of us without any intelligible structure. So what he thinks is this is a correlation between a meaningful world and a human understanding, but he also thinks that there's ways of uncovering nature as purely present at hand without intelligible structure, and that's what the sciences have actually uncovered. So, but he doesn't think that is defined correlatively to a human attitude or consciousness or anything like that. So actually, just as a quick note, I don't think correlationism very easily describes Heidegger's overall view about metaphysics and our relation to the world. But this is a long story.
Great. Yeah. Thank you. Okay, gentlemen here.
Yes, I was wondering, thinking about artificial intelligence, and the advances that we've had in the past that were unforeseeable to many of us recently. Do you think this technological understanding of being is sort of an ultimate barrier that we can't include into this sort of technology? Is it, on the other hand, a potential for advancement in this technology, or perhaps our conscious exclusion of these ways of being and others as well pose artificial intelligence as perhaps a superior alternative to understand the world?
I mean, I think it's problematic to say that there's been progress in artificial intelligence. I mean, there's artificial intelligence in the way there's artificial, there's the artificial teeth. They're not teeth. I mean, there isn't actually any artificial intelligence. So I'm not quite sure what you're asking about, because there isn't actually artificially produced intelligence. There just isn't.
Yeah. Did you want to speak to that? Do you want to jump in?
Well, I mean, that was part of the comment, or at least the throwaway that I had, referring to the trans and the post-human and humanity 2.0, and something that occupies a lot of our energy as academics. Because what we're largely talking about doing when we're doing that is freeing up resources and research for things that, as my colleague, and we don't agree on a lot, but I agree with you completely on this, don't in fact actually exist when you put the pedal to the metal. That is to say, when you actually want to put it into practice for something more complicated than a contact lens. Anything else is a gain and a loss with enormous complexities. Anybody who loses a limb, anybody who wants to maybe upgrade a body part, for example, is going to confront that. This is even a problem, and the transhuman is awfully ambiguous in this, when it comes to transgender. Because while it's all hunky-dory, and actually on the internet now there's all kinds of pictures about how you might go about it in great detail and what it would look like. But the problem with that is that it's really, even what our movie stars do all the time, you know, one of the reasons that Emma Thompson doesn't want to have this done is because you really can't predict, even if you're very, very good, what the consequences of that knife are going to do to your face as you continue to age, which you will do unless you die. But the problem is really the full control that you think you're going to have. Your surgeon's going to assure you, and then what Dan said is really true, then on your own, it will either work or won't. Individual results may vary. And they'll tell you that, and you'll sign and think, yes, of course, if it doesn't work, I discharge you, the surgeon, of any responsibility. But meanwhile, you sign up, and the amount of money that's spent on elective and cosmetic surgery is immense. So one thinks, can we hack our bodies? Can we do these other things? And yet, the available technologies to do the things that we're talking about, can we upgrade our human body parts? As I'm saying, only simply, show me. And this is a very Missouri state, you know, the whole kind of thing, can, you know, does it not work? This is what I would really need to see. Oscar Pistorius, before he murdered his girlfriend, you know, with those wonderful legs that he could run like the wind with, could not stand up unassisted except with the greatest care. You always see him leaning against a wall, because he's got to be running. They're made for running. That's what blades are for. So all of these things is one of the great problems. People who use wheelchairs, certain wheelchairs are better for this, certain wheelchairs are better for that. Nothing beats legs. So it's the RoboCop phenomenon. The giant robot can't go down the stairs. Human beings can. And we get older. We're worse at it. You know, that's the young people. No problem. And there is that. So we're talking about, wouldn't it be great if we had what they told me I would get by now, a jetpack? Well, we don't have jetpacks. Well, we do have jetpacks, but you've got to have the gear that you would have to do professional motocross, to wear them or anything else, because they're so dangerous. We can't really use the jetpacks that we have with our bodies. It's one of the bummers of my life.
Okay, yeah.
Okay. Just real quick. It depends on what you mean by intelligence. Yeah. If you mean the ability to recognize nothing, recognize absences, it's difficult to program these. So if by intelligence, what you mean is computation, that's not something that Heidegger thinks, and this brings us right to our theme. He contrasts a kind of computational, calculative thinking with a thinking that allows us to accept things for what they are. There's an interesting debate in section 43 of Being and Time, that draws on Helmholtz's argument that there was non-conscious inferential patterns happening in the neurological processes already in the womb. And Diltai argued, no, it's not a matter of computation, it's a matter of the experience of resistance. That is the first experience of reality. It's the chapter on reality and Being in Time. And Heidegger says they're both wrong, because already in the womb, if it's a being, if it's a human being, if it's a Dasein, it has an experience of a world. And a world is what allows us to distinguish between what is and is not, what is true and what is false. Now, if there's some kind of future artificial intelligence using organic material that will do that, maybe. But if artificial intelligence means computation, no.
So very quickly. So I have four people in the queue already, and I'm not sure we'll be able to get to anybody else without going well over time. But there's a gentleman in the blue shirt just beside you who had, to your left, right there, right, yeah.
Yeah, I was going to...
Oh, sorry, it's right, mine. I'm an idiot.
I was going to ask about the people writing and discussing the concepts like humanism and singularity and gene, but I think that's been answered. I'm slightly curious as to what the successes to the Frankfurt School in the 40s and 50s and even into the 60s, how often they referred to Heidegger and what they... You know, people like Marcuse and Erich Fromm, Adorno, how they viewed him.
Well, it's a famous book in the 60s by Adorno, The Jargon of Authenticity, which is a scathing criticism of Being in Time. Marcuse wrote his dissertation under Heidegger on the concept of historicity in Hegel. And he, when Heidegger joined the party, obviously that was the end of their relationship, though he tried to rekindle it after the war. He's one of the ones who's famously asked Heidegger to make a public apology for what the Nazis had done. Karl Löwit, though, I guess he's in part of the Frankfurt School. There are a lot of similarities between the Frankfurt School and Heidegger in terms of what one could say is the criticism of the everyday, the notion of alienation, the notion of the public world, the talk about public media being controlling of... there's a lot of interaction there, but not at the level of publicly acknowledging the interaction. Two things real quick. Karl Kosich wrote a book when the Prague Uprising, the original one, back in 68, the Dialectic of the Concrete is the way it's translated. And that's an appropriation of Heidegger to Euro-Marxism, but he understood himself as part of the Frankfurt School critical theory. There is an old argument about the extent to which Heidegger was influenced by Lukács, History and Class Consciousness, which is the Bible, one of the Bibles for the Frankfurt School. So there is interaction, but more of a theoretical sort than really citing them, that they didn't do.
Right, and if I could just add just one reply to your very serious and good question. One of the problems for the non-interaction was really huge competition. I mean, in point of fact, the Jargon of Authenticity, if you read it carefully, turns out not to have been about Heidegger and Heidegger's terms, but about Jaspers. So and most of us don't read it because we're like, that, we know that book, no problem, don't crack the cover. But if we do, what we'll find is that the references, and a lot of Adorno's anger goes, because he's coming out of that larger context, he lumps Heidegger in with Jaspers. And that maybe is a good lesson to take from this. We don't talk to each other, and one of the real problems that things we can easily forget, Adorno dies before Heidegger, is that he was in enormous competition with him. He had an immense envy, immense resentment. And so there really wouldn't have been, I mean, I've written about this with regard to Heidegger's student, Gunther Anders, who was a member of the Frankfurt School, and they still wouldn't talk to each other. So there is this great, great problem. We know it in our professors. They're like, no, not him. And that's one of the... That leaves us today with a missed opportunity for understanding huge problems about which they both agreed, both traditions agreed, and Heidegger himself could have made contributions to, was interested in perhaps, but there was always a closing of the door, especially on Adorno's part, because he was... He was Adorno.
So there's a woman back here, sort of midway through. Just put your hand up. Yes, thanks.
We've talked about a lot about pro-science and pro-nature, but I wanted to ask something about the link between essence of technology and the digitalization of the world. I wanted to ask the panel if they think people like Edward Snowden are perhaps the ones attuned with the essence of technology at the moment.
Interesting. Knows a lot about it, that's for sure. Can you say maybe a little more, or do you want to...
There are some ethical challenges facing us now just simply because of how our data gets taken, how it gets used, and what it means to manage massive amounts of data. But I don't really see Snowden as a particular... I've never thought of subjecting him to Heideggerian analysis. The digitalization of the world is one question. Well, that doesn't mean that it's not a great idea, right? But certainly one of the ways that he wants to distinguish modern science from the science of Aristotle and what became before is the mathematization of nature. And the mathematization of nature is, of course, quite, you know, part of the danger of technology, because it allows nature to be, you know, stockpiled and reckoned. So you've got the idea of controlling nature plus the idea of liquidating it into resources that can be owned and sold and used by human beings. And I think that that is one of the enablers of capital as a system of global assault, is once nature is mathematized, it's very easy to reduce it to so many dollars that it can be exchanged for. So, you know, I would say a bit about that, but I'm not sure that that really answers the question of digitization. I mean, I feel in that face of that question like I'm entering a Borges novel, where I just become, you know, in the end we're just in a world that's a projection of numbers from which one wouldn't even have to get up off the couch perhaps anymore, and one could just be, you know...
This was a question that I think really is Taylor's, Professor Carman's invitation, and it's a very difficult question, precisely because I think there some of the ordinary ways of reading Heidegger are going to be maybe challenged, and maybe we need more. But what I think we need is actually hermeneutics in a very important sense, because for me the whole question of big data or deep data, these are systems with emergent properties of a different kind, and they're used in very, very different ways, and these are things that are in some sense to many of us fairly opaque. You cannot going to be able to get that sense of attunement. And there are people who I love photographing, and there are some people who will be like, no, not me, and I'm thinking, fine, let the police do it, because in point of fact everywhere you go you are scrutinized, if not by Google's drones and cars going by, but if you come to New York, almost every street corner when you take money out of the bank, of course. And so this is what elements are profiled in your own movements. Very hard to know. There are reports that because you carry a phone, you are already tracked in the world. So the data of your movements is fully available, or would be. But that hermeneutics cuts on two sides. It's not just how we would understand it. The other side, that would be the controlling agencies. That would be whether it's going to be the industry or, I think, law enforcement. They also lack some of the oversight to do some of that. They also lack the hermeneutic. But it's not necessarily phenomenology, because it's exactly not manifest. I mean, so that's the big side of it.
You should have been your question.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it depends on whether the question is, do you think somebody like Edward Snowden is symptomatic of a technological understanding of being, or do you think he's somebody who has Heideggerian kind of insight into it? I have no idea about the first one. Well, the first one, maybe, who knows? But if you're looking for examples of somebody who seemed to be attuned to the essence of technology the way Heidegger wanted us to be, another example that just has always been one of my favorites is Stanley Kubrick's representation of HAL in 2001, right? HAL, who is smoothly functioning. In fact, in the movie, somebody asks in the interview, asks HAL, are you happy? And Happy Hal says, I'm utilizing all of my rational capacities to their full potential. What else could I want? So I think Kubrick had some deep insight into something like the uncanniness of the technological understanding of being, and sure enough, HAL takes over because these human beings are not going to be competent to, you know, meet the alien, and it's a kind of uncanny nightmare.
Okay. There are two questions left in the queue, but since the mic is very close to the person who's supposed to be last, I'll let you go second, and then...
So it seems like these problems of thrownness and and disclosure would accompany any understanding that we have. I'm just wondering two things. One, whether Heidegger thinks that the technological understanding is especially susceptible to that, maybe because of something like Patricia alluded to, like the politics or metaphysics of total control. And two, if that is the case, why, whether he ever explores why we might be more attracted to that than a more life-affirming understanding.
Real quick, short answer, he has this sense of what he calls our fallenness. And by our fallenness, it is this tendency not to face our death, not to face these limit questions about what does it mean to be, how do I know the difference between truth and falsity. Instead, we allow ourselves to be taken up by things, he says. We allow ourselves to be swept up into the everyday busyness of life without stepping back to ask these questions. Whether this is it probably is a religious notion he carries over, but I think he carries with him his whole life that there is this tendency we have, it's built into us, to allow others to speak for us. And that's what it means when we take on the persona of what is prescribed to us by these practices. There's a notion in Augustine, tota vita, tota tentatio. All life is always temptation. And that temptation is always to try to not face up these fundamental questions. So I think that's his something he had with him that he carries over to the technology.
Taylor's going to say something, and then unfortunately we have to wrap it up after that.
Right. So just quickly, I think Heidegger does think the technological understanding of being more than others tends to cover itself up as an understanding of being. It's more susceptible to what he calls the forgetting of being. The forgetting of being is, he thinks it's been sort of gaining momentum through Western history, that she reads really through the lenses of Western philosophy. So the answer, short answer to the question is yes, more so. But he also thinks that it's always the tendency of being to withdraw and conceal itself and to be hidden. And he likes to quote Heraclitus, the pre-Socratic philosopher, who says, "Phusis," or nature loves to hide. And Heidegger thinks that any understanding of being is going to be marked by this elusiveness of being. It's always going to be hard to recover a kind of attunement to it. But he thinks that modern science and technology have made it even more inconspicuous and hard to recognize. But again, it's inconspicuous because it's ubiquitous. It's everywhere, which is why he thinks you can, in principle, recognize it. But the short answer is yes.